Podcasting from the beautiful Mile High City, you're listening to the Do It Again podcast, the official podcast of Scientific Wrestling, the undisputed leader in no-holds-barred, catch-as-catch-can wrestling. Here's your host, Jake Shannon.
Again, podcast, the official podcast of Scientific Wrestling, the undisputed leader in no holds barred catches catch can wrestling. I am your host, Jake Shannon, and today I've got a guy who is one of the coolest dudes in the whole kind of catch wrestling scene, or I don't know what the hell. People call it the catch wrestling community. I really don't like that term. I mean, whatever. Anyway, in the scene, there's this dude. And he is just so cool. And I got him on the line. So without further ado, I will give more of his like background and stuff. But I can't wait to get him on. I've got with me on the other line, Sean Dougherty. Sean, are you there? Can you hear us?
Yeah, I'm here. How you doing?
Awesome, dude. So Sean is, he holds a special place for me because in terms of, you know, the business side of catch wrestling, it has almost entirely, since my time in when I really started in you know, trying to do stuff in it in 2003, it really has been the UFC that has driven most of the interest in the resurgence of catch. I mean, I've been there to push and all that, but it was this interest in the UFC and grappling and jiu-jitsu that really has driven the growth of catch wrestling. I think it was 1994, I was going to the University of Colorado Boulder. I was really active in grappling there at the rec center. And one of my buddies, who's a judo guy that I worked out with, he and I decided to go to this crazy thing, and it was UFC 2. And it was down in Denver at this place called the Mammoth Event Center. And I got to know a guy. Well, I got to see the whole UFC, but the first match, I come to find out years later when I'm into all this catch wrestling stuff, was Sean. He was the very first MMA fight I ever saw in 1994. And to me, that whole event was cathartic. It literally changed the course of my whole life because I got involved with grappling at a much deeper level than just fooling around at judo and stuff like that. Got involved with jiu-jitsu, in pro wrestling, and then through pro wrestling got very involved in catch wrestling. So Sean has been there since the very beginning, but what is even crazier than him being in the first UFC that I ever attended back in 94 is that he was also one of the original members of Ken Shamrock's Lion's Den back in the day. So I want to talk to Sean about all that because he's been around for so long. Sean, what, like, maybe you could tell everybody about that first time that you, that first UFC that you did. I mean, what was the story behind that? How'd you get in? Because I always, the reason I ended up going into pro wrestling is that I could never get, there were no events back then. There was no MMA events. There was no grappling events, hardly at all, other than like judo tournaments and stuff. And like, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay. So how did you stumble onto it? I mean, that's just so crazy.
Well, I watched the very first UFC with my buddies. Two of my friends and we were watching it and just something came over me and I just said, you know what, I'm going to be in the next one.
Now you were doing kickboxing then, right?
Yeah, I was a kickboxer, karate guy, you know, just some, you know, all stand up type stuff.
Yep.
You know, I thought, oh, if anybody tries to shoot in on me, I'll just knee them or I'll just kick them. Or,
well, back then all we had were like karate movies and shit. Like there was no like real...
Yeah, Van Damme and Steven Seagal were two major, you know, it was past Chuck Norris's time. You know, we entered into Van Damme and Steven Seagal. You know, Above the Law was like my favorite movie at the time.
Yeah.
You know, so I took a little, you know, I was taking a little bit of Aikido on the side, you know, with my kickboxing and Taekwondo. But, you know, I mean, but, you know, the UFC, you know, comes out and it's pitting style versus style. This is way before we get the idea of MMA, of mixing all the martial arts, but they, you know, but it was an infomercial for Gracie's.
Yeah, 100%, 100%.
You know, grapplers versus strikers, you know. The only main anomaly was Ken.
Right. So you get booked, but like, how do you get booked? Because, I mean, literally back then, everybody was doing like karate or kickboxing or taekwondo or something. So how did you get involved?
This is where quantum mechanics probably falls into play.
A little magic, huh?
Yeah, no, truly. You know, I put my intention out there by simply saying and believing that
I would
be the next one.
Yeah.
And it just so happened that a friend of mine, Kelly and Bill Gallant, were running a tournament up in Buffalo, New York. So I offered to them that I would, you know, they asked me if I would come and help judge and referee and all that kind of shit. And, you know, which was just a week right after the UFC 2. UFC 1. And then when I get up there, they turns out that they're friends with Kevin Rozier. Remember that guy? UFC 1?
Yeah, UFC 1.
He's the one that fought, I think, Zane Frazier.
Right.
Stomping him to death.
Right.
You know, and they asked him what his tactic was, and he says, let him hit me. You know, let him, you know, tire out, you know.
And I'll
beat him up.
So like a rope-a-dope. Like kind of a rope-a-dope strategy.
Yeah, yeah, and he was always unheard of, but he was big in Japan. He was a kickboxer in Japan, K-1 style, you know, type stuff, you know, the old kickboxing in Japan rules. But I met him because he had a setup out in the lobby, like a meet and greet of the event. It was inside of a hotel, so he was in the foyer with a setup. And I talked to him, and I was like, you know, without even thinking about UFC, I just said, hey, I want to become a pro kickboxer, and there's no way to do it where I'm at. Would you be willing to train?
Right.
So he had a friend named Dennis Engard, who was down in the area where I'm at now, who had a kickboxing stable and friends with Mickey Skadova, another guy out here. These local kickboxers, and they had a fight set up, and I took the match, and it was kind of like not an initiation, but kind of like an evaluation, like, yeah, this guy's good, so why don't you take him under your wing? So the next thing I know, I'm moving to Buffalo, New York.
Wow.
New Year's Day of 1994.
Now, wait a minute, and you're super, wait, because this is important. You're crazy young, too, right? Like, aren't you the youngest fighter to be in the UFC, or?
No, the UFC, whoever mined my data, like, for some reason, Sherdog was the first to fuck it up. They have me born like in December of 1975 or 4 or something like that, when I was born in April of 75. So it said that I was like 18 years and 3 months, and Dan Lausen was 18 years and 6 months. But in all actuality, it was 18 years and 10 or 11 months. So Dan Lausen has me beat by a few months.
I see. Okay, but you were crazy. I mean, you were like a baby, dude. Before Lausen, you were like, for 20 years or whatever, 15 years, the youngest dude.
Correct.
Wow. So you go to Buffalo. So wait a minute. So now you get this thing. And man, I mean, literally, if you were around back then, there was like, you know, it's interesting you say that about like the law of attraction, because it was like, there was nothing, man. Like you do a lot of stuff with Grappling Industries, right?
I used to. I no longer.
Oh, so you don't. Them. But what's interesting is like, look how many opportunities there are for these guys now. There was none of that, dude. There was none of that.
Dude, Ohio is one of the best states for MMA right now.
That's so crazy. And that's 25 years, you know, 25 years of effort. And now it's like everywhere these kids get to do it. It's pretty an amazing time. So you go out to New York, and these guys are connected to the bookers for the UFC, or?
Okay, so I move out Kevin Rozier turns out to be mentally unstable. He's an Army veteran.
Okay.
So he was, you know, he had a cocaine addiction. You know, there's all kinds of things, you know, going on, bipolar, manic depression.
Sure. So you kind of needed to move on.
Yeah, I'm 18 years old in 40 below weather with one of the greatest snowstorms in history in Buffalo, Jesus. New York. You know, so I'm living out of my car or whoever can let me spend the night at night. So I'm there for like a month where, you know, he's taking me out, coke binging. And, you know, I'm 18 years old thinking, you know, like, oh, professional martial arts, you know, this is where it really gets good. You know, Taekwondo aims to achieve, you know, self-control, self-confidence, discipline, you know, indomitable spirits, you know. All that shit's out the window when you get into the professional world of fighting because it's pretty seedy and fucked up.
Well, especially in the in the early days before there's any real like established institutions or networks that everybody knows. I mean, it's like the Wild West.
It's completely the fucking Wild West, dude. It's insane.
So you're chasing your dream. You're chasing your dream. You're in this crazy situation as a young man, freezing your ass off, like homeless, basically.
Yeah. Exactly. And his manager, Charlie Anzalone. Okay. So back up just a second. He checks himself in the mental ward of the VA hospital.
Okay.
And he tells me to run his kickboxing school.
And you're like 18.
I came to learn from him, but he's having me do this.
Oh, you know, my
this
gosh.
You know, my empath stuff and, you know, my willingness to help others and not give up on people really started to shine. And, but anyways, his manager said, you know, Sean, if I would have known you were coming, I would have told you don't do this because
the, not because the state where he was at. Yeah.
Right, right, right. He goes, but how would you like to fight in the next UFC? I'm going out to meet with Art Davey and blah, blah, blah. But Charlie,
so wait a minute. Wait. So I want to clock the law of attraction here for you. You're this magical thing. So how long elapsed between when you made that verbal like statement to your friends to where this guy's like, you want to fight in the next UFC?
November of 1993, whenever that UFC was, I think it was like, what, November 11th or something? I can't remember.
Yeah, it was fall.
Till about end of January, mid-January.
That's insane.
Yep.
But so you had to, but you had to take action. You had to like uproot and go and chase this dream and take crazy risks.
Yeah, it took work. Yes, yes. You have to fucking do the work. You can't just say, oh, I want this or I want that in the law of attraction. You have to do the fucking work.
Right.
You have to work your ass off and be willing to take risks and be willing to do even the things that might even be completely contradictory to what you think you know.
Right.
You know, you have to be able to trust in a way. That's true faith to me. I mean, that's, you know, not knowing the outcome, not understanding what's ahead and doing it anyways.
So the magic works mixed with your hard work and risk taking and suffering a little bit in upstate New York, freezing your ass off. So you get the offer and so what happens? Like they give you a contract, you sign the contract.
Yeah, well, Charlie goes out to Torrance and meets with Art. I get a call from Charlie saying you will be in the next UFC, UFC 2, but you're going to be an alternate. And
I see. Okay. Prepared. Cool.
So get prepared. So, you know, I started training on my own the best I could.
You're watching a lot of you're watching a lot of Van Damme videos at Blockbuster.
Basically
getting psyched up.
You know, I'm hitting the heavy bag a lot, sparring with my partners and stuff like that.
Yep.
And you know, I'm just going in to put my nuts on the line, you know, thinking, you know, I got a good chance at this, you know, I'm you know, I was an undefeated kickboxer at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, whatever the record is out there that's being said is quite conflated, you know, because that was because of Charlie and Art at the time, just to make it look like, you know, I wasn't such a young kid. I had my real record is like 8-0, but we said it was like 15-0.
Yeah, right.
Kickboxing,
so right?
That, you know how the show biz goes.
Got to sell tickets, dude.
I'm breaking the kayfabe at this.
Yeah, and however, wait. But that's a good point. That's a great point. All these fuckers that don't understand the actual business side of things, like, Kayfabe's in fucking MMA. It's in all the fight sports, dude. Like, there's you're selling tickets. You're having to make a living with this shit.
And you don't want to sound like, you know, you got this little kid who just graduated.
like it's almost abusive to have this like 18-year-old right. doe-eyed young man come in into the cage. That's amazing.
Dude, you got fucking, you know, the worst kick in the nuts was when Jim Brown says that young man had no business being here.
Oh, that's rough. Yeah, yeah. So, well, okay.
Fuck you, Jim Brown. You
yeah, you yeah. What are you?
Playing idiot. You're a football player. What the fuck do you know about?
Yeah, I always laughed at that early commentary, man. It's some crazy shit, those early ones.
They had Brian Kilmeade next to him, like, with that little Fox fucker.
Oh, yeah, he's on Fox and Friends. You know what? I never made that connection till right now. Oh, my God. Are you serious? That guy went on to that?
Yes.
Oh, Jesus. Yes. Oh, my
Dude,
God.
That's a weird little nugget.
Oh, my you know? God. That is crazy. Oh, my God.
So 2 weeks prior to the airing of the UFC, when I was supposed to show up, Art Davey calls me. And he says, Sean Dougherty, how are you? This is Art Davey. You know, I'm calling to let you know that Ken Shamrock broke his hand in training, and we need you to fill his spot out as on
Jesus.
The main card.
Jesus.
How do you feel about that? You okay with that? And I'm like, well, fuck yeah.
Yeah, excited, right.
You know, why wouldn't I be? You know, and in a lot of ways, I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to fight in the UFC. I might get noticed. Maybe I can do something in Hollywood because I wanted to be a stuntman.
Sure.
You know, that's what I really was like going for. You know, I wanted to be a fucking stuntman.
Yeah, that's cool.
In fight movies, you know, like Gene LaBelle.
Yes, sir. You know? And, yes, sir.
I didn't know who Gene LaBelle was at the time. But later on, you know, I figured it out. So now it's like, okay, now it's real. Okay, now I'm definitely going to be fighting this and that. And some of the trivia is about Sean Dougherty. And these are toilet readings and what I say. I'm just kind of a gimmick in a lot of ways with the UFC because I never fought in after this. But I was the youngest. I was the first Ohioan. I was Big John McCarthy's first Let's Get It On for ever refereed.
Oh, nice.
You know what I mean?
Oh, cool.
So, and there's just weird, you know, little things that are just neat, you know? And I
Yeah, no, that's awesome.
When I tell them that, but you got to do it. You were brave enough to put your nuts on. You know, they're always trying to, like, not let me feel so, you know, self-depraved about it. It's like, no, guys, really, the reality of it is that it's really not that big of a fucking deal.
Well, yeah, but dude, to you, yeah, but to you, because you were a magic, you were a magical motherfucker, and everything just like you did all the blood and guts and risk, and it worked out. Like, I'm just telling you, dude, for a guy like me,
it helped me throughout the rest of my life. It helped me through the rest of my life, though. I am grateful for it. I am beyond grateful that I was able to fight in the UFC, and I am beyond grateful that I was able to have that experience because of how other people perceive it, it gives me a job. You know, it's kept me employed. It's helped me get jobs.
Dude, you're part of history because there's just no denying that, honestly, like back then, none of us knew. We all thought it was going to be like, me and my friends thought it was going to be like one or two shows. We never thought that this would ever turn into a fucking thing. And to have it turn into like something, a company that was sold for $4 billion is worldwide. I mean, dude, you are literally part of history. And it's so weird. I know because like you were there and it was not a big deal back then. You know what I mean? How you are. But I mean, it's amazing. Like for a guy like me that was there because I was so excited about it. I never knew this thing kind of existed. To be able to meet you that kind of lived the dream is just, I mean, it's so cool, man. That is such like, you know, a thing for me personally. It's amazing to know you as a friend. It really is.
Speaking of that, you know, we should mention, you know, like, and this is the picture you should probably use for this podcast. It's a picture of me, you, and my son.
Oh, yeah. At Mammoth.
Mammoth Gardens last year.
Yeah. Okay. Good idea.
You know, that was the 25-year anniversary of UFC, but it was the 24th anniversary. But I was in Denver on my 25th anniversary of UFC 2.
Yeah, that's, I mean.
You know, so it's kind of cool. I mean, that should be the picture you use.
I think you're right.
You in it, me in it, and my son, who is actually the age I was when I fought.
That is so crazy, dude. He's so young. He's so young. That is so good. So you do this thing. You get the bug. You train your ass off. You take the risk. You end up getting in the fight. You're young. It's your first time. I mean, you know, what the hell? Everybody is like making mistakes and not at their best at 18. So, but you get put on the map, and that's where, right? And I don't want to steal your thunder. You tell the story better than me, but that's where Shamrock was like, hey, dude, come on.
Yep. He, what happened was, Ken noticed me. He was training, with some guys like helping, I think Jason DeLucia, like he approached Jason DeLucia to ask him to come live with him at the Lions Den. And, I was training that day and he saw me training and, you know, he was like, hey, you know, like I saw what you were doing. I see that you have a lot of potential. You're young. You're perfect for what I'm looking for to build up the Lions Den and go fight in Pancrase. And basically, you know, we had dinner one night and he pitched to me, hey, you know, come live and train with me. You don't have to be initiated. You and Jason don't have to be initiated because you're already proving yourself here.
Well, you already fought in UFC too.
Well, no. I mean, like, this is like a lead up to the fight before my fight.
Oh, this is before the fight. Wow.
Yeah. So right after I lost, to a ninja, which is a good, the teaching thing that I'm about to say is that even ninjutsu's grappling is superior to striking arts.
Yeah,
I got
right.
guillotine, you know, I got head and arm choked after a sacrifice throw. And, oh, I actually pulled him on top of me full mount, but I didn't know what the fuck I was doing.
Right. But, not a grappler at that time.
I was grabbing his love handles and trying to do pressure points on Aikido, which was how I learned that stuff is bullshit.
Right.
Aikido,
right.
Whatever you want to
call it. Right.
You know, and I was like, okay. So I was pissed off. I was upset. It was my first loss ever.
Oh, wow. Yeah, on the biggest stage. Like, yeah, that's crazy.
Right. So I'm like, fuck. You know, and I'm pissed off, and I have so much energy because I lost within, like, 40 seconds.
Right.
It went that fast. And, you know, Ken literally, he pulled me over into the audience, you know, to sit next to him. And he gave me my first lesson. And he's like, look. Here is your first lesson as a professional. Fucking keep your composure. You know, don't let it show. Have some dignity. You know, it's not over for you.
Yeah, yeah. You know? It's just beginning, in fact.
Right. You know, so I go home and I take my winnings and I buy a ounce of weed and a few tabs of mescaline and I trip.
Okay, wait, stop. This is the perfect commercial break because now everybody's forced to listen to these fucking commercials. All right.
Okay.
Okay, so guys, we're going to come back with Sean Dougherty. Sean, man, it's just one of my favorite people in the whole scene. He's just such a wealth of knowledge. It's just a cool dude. Come on back, guys, after the break. Sean Dougherty, the Do It Again podcast. Talk to you in a second. Guys, we are back. Thrilled to be talking to my friend Sean Dougherty. Now, Sean, before the break, you were telling this whole story how you ended up in the UFC and you got through the point where you lost to a ninja on the biggest stage you'd ever been on, and how Ken Shamrock pulled you aside and was giving you some tips on composing yourself, on being a pro, on behaving professionally in this business. And you're talking about you took your winnings back home and bought an ounce of weed and some mescaline. Okay, now, please continue. I'm sorry for the interruption, but that is the greatest lead-up. That's the greatest commercial break lead-up in history, possibly.
So I'm tripping balls, right? You know, this one night I'm with my buddy Dan Woodburn, and it was just the best trip I ever had in my life. And I knew it was just at midpoint in the peak, I knew that I needed to make the next step, get the fuck out of Ohio,
yeah,
take Ken up on his offer to be a member of the Lions Den. And so I took the rest of my winnings and bought a plane ticket and flew out to Lodi, California.
Wow. Wow.
Bob Shamrock.
Dude, that's like the greatest investment. Dude, the money that was the greatest investment you ever made, dude. Like, you bought weed, got some mescaline, and had like a Jim Morrison Vision Quest, and then and a plane ticket to Ken Shamrock's house. That's amazing.
Yep. That's literally how it happened. I mean, there's
that's amazing, dude.
I'm not exaggerating. It's just how it
fucking. I just love it. It's so amazing. That's so real. All right. Okay. Keep going.
So, I get the plane ticket. I fly out. Bob Shamrock picks me up, and we go out to eat immediately afterwards. He lets me know the next day we're gonna go pick up Jason, DeLucia. You know, because like before, okay, so rewind just a quick second. We were at the UFC. Me and Jason talked to each other, and we were talking about Ken. We were both talking about, like, well, what do you think? Are you going to do it? I don't know. Are you going to do it? Like, I don't know, man. You know, neither one of us decided yet. So we hadn't talked to each other since then, you know, when I landed.
Right.
You know, so it was like, oh, shit, cool. He's coming. Fuck yeah. You know, because when I first saw the UFC, check this out. This goes back to the magic, you know, is that Ken Shamrock stood out to me.
Oh, okay? Dude, he looked like a god compared to everybody else.
Right. Well, you know what? I thought he was a dick, though. Like, video, like, you know, but it was after he lost to Hoist, it was his composure. He was like, you know, he wasn't a dick about it.
Yeah.
He wasn't like, well, fuck that guy. Blah, blah, blah. You know, I saw him beat Pat Smith and then lose to Hoist and, you know, and it was like, wow, okay, first I thought he was a dick, now I think he's cool, you know, kind of.
Right, right.
DeLucia stood out to me too.
Yeah.
He was actually the first person to do a rear naked choke in the UFC when he fought Trent Jenkins.
Oh, wow.
Right? So, like, those two people stood out to me, and Kevin Rozier did too. Like, there was this link, there was this feeling, this, like, to all three of those people, those are the three people that stood out to me the most.
Yeah.
And all three of those people were integral parts of my martial arts journey.
Right.
Kevin being my introduction, getting into the UFC. The UFC leading me to Ken Shamrock and Jason DeLucia. Like, matter of fact, when Charlie Anzalone got me, you know, he's the one that actually went and picked me up for the... When I landed for the UFC, the first thing I said is, take me to Jason DeLucia. I have to go meet that guy.
Right. Dude, he was a stud, because I remember when I first saw him too, and he was coming from like more of a kung fu thing, right? And I remember...
Fight animal kung fu, yeah.
Yeah, I remember right then. See, what got me to get to the UFC was actually that Bruce Lee biography with Jason Scott Lee, the Dragon movie. Do you remember that from that time period? And I remember... I really thought, I was like, oh, dude, that DeLucia guy is kind of living that dream. Like, he's really fighting. He's continuing on Bruce Lee's kind of vibe. You know, I thought he was so cool.
Yeah, yeah. So he was doing underground MMA matches already. Not MMA, no holds barred fights.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, well, he was in that Gracie. He was in, like, Gracie in Action 2 or something as well before UFC or something.
Right, right. So he was in Gracie in Action, right? Like, so before that, he was trying to go fight Steven Seagal in California.
Dude, like, Steven Seagal, it's so awesome.
That offer. So Jason DeLucia every day went to Steven Seagal's dojo waiting for that fucker and to take him up on his offer, you know, that he put in Black Belt Magazine that he'll fight anybody, anytime.
And nothing ever happened, huh?
Nope. Yeah. And so what he saw was this other article of the Gracie in Action, you know, the Gracie Challenge.
Yeah,
and
he's right.
Like, okay, that's just right down the road. I'm going to go do this. So that's the backdrop story behind him fighting Hoist Gracie.
I see. Stuff. Yeah, yeah. But, dude, I just remember thinking that guy was such a stud because he was really, like, exemplifying what Bruce Lee was promoting, you know, that.
Dude, there's so many unsung heroes out there. I think of that song Helmet, you know.
Yeah.
Unsung, you know, but there's so many unsung heroes out there. Jason DeLucia is one of the biggest bricks that helped pave the way to this. I mean, he had the right mentality.
Yep.
He had learned judo, a little bit of judo. That's why so after fighting Hoist, he went and learned judo, and by the time he got in UFC 2, he was now dangerous, because people don't remember this. Is that in UFC? Okay. So hold on. This is how he got into UFC 1. Was he was told by Horion that if you want a rematch, because Jason did not like how it ended.
Sure, so sure. And that match with him and Hoist in that gym on that Gracie in Action tape or whatever. It's actually a really good match. I mean, honestly, it really is.
It is, especially for a kung fu guy fighting.
Yeah, it's a really good match.
You know. Jason had a very open mind about it all, and he truly, you know, is a martial artist. You know, he knew that he had to learn more things. So after that, he learned judo, and he came back, and when he fought Scott Baker, you know, he choked him out with a triangle choke. People don't realize that, you know. Wow. Like, a lot of people probably won't even remember that from UFC 2 or
UFC. Dude, I mean, it's, the things have changed so much in 25 years. Half the guys don't even remember Sakuraba, let alone the early days before it was fucking...
God, isn't that a fucking shame, dude?
It's crazy to me. It's so crazy, but it's just, I guess it comes with getting old, you know?
You know, you got all these jiu-jitsu guys talking about this Kimura lock system. Motherfucker, go watch fucking, you know, Sakuraba versus all the Gracies.
It's unbelievable. Fun.
With,
I mean,
a fucking double top wrist lock, you know, with a double wrist lock.
I do want to get back to your story, but like, seriously, what a mind blower for those of us that were like aware of it during that time when Sakuraba kind of came on the scene, right? Because it was kind of this foregone conclusion that the jiu-jitsu thing was the thing. It was like a law of physics, you know? And here comes Sakuraba and he's like cracking jokes and spanking people and smoking cigarettes and just smokes through everybody. I mean, wasn't that a mind blower?
Oh, yeah, I mean, well, for me it wasn't, because I was now keen to how everything was.
Yeah, yeah, true. I guess you had a whole different perspective.
You know what I mean? I was like, finally, the truth is being told.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, like, I'm on the side of Jay. So I went straight to Ken's, right? So I was team Ken Shamrock.
Wow.
Not team Gracie.
Right.
I was anti-Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Well, it wasn't even called. I was anti-Gracie jiu-jitsu for so long because of my
of your squad.
My loyalty to Ken and catch wrestling.
Yeah. Know? Yeah.
So I was like, I was always telling people, this is not all there fucking is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whoa, hoist beat Ken. I go, well, Ken just got done with a 3-day fucking tournament just a few days prior. You know, Hoist was in the Alps or not the Alps, fucking, it was in Aspen, you know, for months getting used to the acclimation.
Right. And then there's the gi. I mean, the gi changes things.
Yeah. You know, like, Ken never fought anybody in a fucking gi. He says, you're like, what the fuck?
Right.
You know, and Hoist beat him with basically a backwards Ezekiel choke, you know, from the back.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, Ken was ignorant. Ken was just simply, he
well, but see, I mean, look at the game now. You can't wear a gi now.
No.
So, I mean, you know, like...
Well, let's go to the super fight, though. Let's fast forward. You know, when Ken was now keen to everything and was training, you know, and there were lead up to the super fight between him and Hoist, Ken beat the piss out of him.
Right.
You know what I mean?
That wasn't even like... I mean, that was like, what, 3 years? No, it was like 2 years later.
Yeah. And here's what Elio had to say to Ken. Elio said, I feel so sorry for Hoist. You know, before their fight, you know, Elio literally told Ken, I feel sorry for Hoist.
Wow.
For what's about to happen.
Yeah. So, okay. So, again, some of these young cats aren't even going to know these things. And that's why I'm so excited to have you on. Dude, so you go to the Lion's Den, and that's just got to be like a whole other level. You know, this catch wrestling level that Ken kind of got from Fujiwara and Carl Gotch and stuff. So you enter into the Lion's Den. What is that like? Like, how was your prior training compared to what you were getting at the Lion's Den?
Absolutely night and day. Like, I never fathomed or knew that it was like that. So the first day, you know, Jason and I... Okay, so Jason and I get there first, right?
Yeah.
Like, I get there first, and then Jason... And then we hear about this Frank Juarez guy, who's you know, presently at that time was getting ready to be released from Folsom.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, Bob and Ken had already been communicating and talking about, you know, we're gonna give him our name of Shamrock.
Right, guys. It's, know, Frank Shamrock is who he's talking, you know, about. Frank Juarez was his name before he came into the fold. But yeah, okay, just so people know. Right.
Yeah, yeah, and he's, you know, but what's cool about that, let me stop there and just say what's awesome about that is that, you know, they were planning on giving this guy a new life.
Yep.
You know what I mean? It's a wonderful, beautiful story, actually.
It is.
You know what I mean? It's, you know, because, you know, the prison isn't the end of the road. You know, Frank, you know, any of our differences that we may have ever had, you know, he was good for the sport and it was necessary. Back to the magic of it all.
Yeah.
You know, I got to witness some of the most marvelous things, you know. So they go pick up Frank from Folsom and bring him back. Me and Jason are like, oh man, we're getting a fucking.
I mean, dude, you have here. To. I mean, you have to say this. Well, you have to say this because, you know, there was the early UFC and then there's the modern UFC. And Frank, as a proponent of the Shamrock way and the system and the Ken Shamrock training, was the man, the prototype athlete that transitioned it from the old style into the new style. I mean, wouldn't you say that's fair?
Fuck yeah. Yeah. Like there's two main people that I would call that to: Marco Huaz and Frank Shamrock.
Yes. Yes.
They're the ones who were the first true mixed martial artists that really like emboldened what we see today in mixed martial arts, like how a mixed martial artist fighter fights, looks, you know, the matches go, you know, they were the first. Yeah. Especially Frank, you know, as far as being Mexican American, and you know, it's cool is that he's a minority, and he fucking, you know, Mexican Indian. I believe that's his background, but he really had an open mind. You know, he was very arrogant, you know, when I knew him at first and everything.
Sure, dude, coming out of prison and having to be like tough all the time and shit.
Yeah, you know, but when he got initiated by Ken, you know, he comes walking in, he's eating a Carl's Jr. burger. And right before the initiation, which was 20 minutes with Ken, full go, pancreas rules. First thing Ken does is breaks his nose, breaks a rib, and then chokes him unconscious.
Wow.
And then Frank is revived and runs straight to the bathroom, throws up, and finishes his initiation.
Wow! Well, that's studly, dude. That's pretty studly.
Yeah, me and Jason are sitting off to the side watching this, like looking at each other, like, "Oh my fuck!" I'm so glad we didn't have to do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like this fucking sucks, you know. But hey. You know, the fucker has, this is the thing about Frank Shamrock is that the dude has a mind of steel.
Yeah.
You know, and he believed his own bullshit.
Yeah, you know? Dude. I mean, his story is an incredible redemption story. Like one of the great redemption stories in sports, you know, to come from and have those many bumps as he did and to end up in a good place. You know what I mean? Relatively speaking to his past. So
I mean he's got health issues now. I mean his body's broken down and shit like that, but you know, go back to being, you know, your question about, you know, what's it like at Lions then versus my previous training is, you know, my first day we did 500 squats, 200 push-ups, 500 sit-ups, run 2 miles, you know, Hindu push-ups, you know, all these kind of things. And then the next day and the third day, Jason and I, like, I couldn't, my bedroom was upstairs and I couldn't
fucking get up the stairs.
Right. Like, I was taking a shit, right?
Couldn't get up. Were so,
yeah. My legs can't break plane. Like I have to keep them locked out. So for me to wipe my ass, I had to get up, lock my legs out, bend in a 90 degree angle and put my head on the counter of the seat and wipe my ass.
I don't mean to laugh, but it's just one of those things. Unless you've been through,
it's funny.
Unless you've been through these workouts, if you've never been through a workout like that, you don't know. Like and you know, like these, like the Sean's a tough guy, and I, dude, that's so real, dude. It's brutal.
And that's the minimum. That was the fucking baseline. You know, and on the other days, you know, every single day, you know, okay, so our regiment was like this. So here's another tidbit. I was a young boy.
Yeah.
Okay, I was treated like a young boy.
So wait a minute. For people,
for pancreas.
For people who don't know, because people don't know what young boy is. That's most people. For what most people, okay, so the young boy is actually like a system in Japan where if you're a trainee and you're learning with a master, you do the maps or I'm sorry, you mop the mats, you cook the rice, you clean the house. You're like, you know what I mean? That's how you pay your way. Yeah. That's how you pay your way through chores and stuff, basically.
So I was a servant to everybody on team.
Wow. Wow.
You know, and Ken said, you know, the Japanese will respect you more if you do this.
Right.
So they made me shave my head, which was the tradition of a young boy.
Yep.
So my head was shaved. That's why the picture that anybody sees of me with Ken and Jason and Frank
Buzz
with the original lines, then my head was shaved.
Yeah.
That was forced upon me, not
wow.
You know, I willingly did it, you know, because I'm like, okay,
it was a condition of staying
the right path. Yeah, I mean, I wanted all my life, if it was the hardest thing to do, I wanted it.
Yeah,
you know, I
you like the challenge.
Yeah, and it was a, you know, I don't know if it was healthy or the right thing or whatever, but I always felt that I was supposed to do whatever the hardest path was.
And I would say that being a part of the Lion's Den is definitely sticking to that plan.
Oh, yeah. The main thing I learned from Ken was mental toughness, tenacity, you know, and a never quit attitude. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Me being there ingrained in me for the rest of my life. I mean, afterwards, you know, later on down the road, I joined the Air Force, tried out for pararescue and combat control 3 times. And that was nothing compared to the training that I went through under Ken.
Yeah, sure. I believe it. I believe it. I mean, all the stories are crazy legendary. So you're training there with Ken. You're doing all this crazy stuff. You're a young man. You're still not even 20, right?
No, I turned 19 there.
Jesus. So then you start getting booked in Pancrase, which is, again, to me, for me personally, you know, guys like Josh Barnett, like, he's like, oh, UWFI is my favorite thing. And it's great. I love the UWFI. And there's all these other great ones. And there was like the Pro Wrestling Fujiwara Gumi, which is where Ken kind of came into the Fujiwara and the catch wrestling and stuff. But to me, Pancrase will always be, I mean, Pride comes a close second, but Pancrase will always be the greatest promotion, dude, to me.
I agree. You know, I'm still friends with Pancrase.
Not the modern Pancrase, the old shit that you got to take a part in. That is like, to me, that is just the coolest fucking thing in the world.
The rule sets where your match can last up to a half hour and the rope escapes and shit like that. That is the marathon of MMA matches.
And I love the open hand strikes too, because then you don't have to get gloves. You don't have to get the commissions really get all that involved, but you still get to have the impact and stuff. It's very, to me, Pancrase, I mean, you know me, Sean, like my whole mission is really to bring back catch wrestling. I don't know if I can ever do it on the level of like how Art Davey or those guys have done with these other promotions. But my whole idea is, man, this is a great sport. It doesn't need to be worked pro wrestling. And to me, Pancrase is the closest that we've gotten in 100 years.
Oh yeah. I would love to see the best thing that we could ever do is start a Pancrase, old school Pancrase rules event again.
Oh, it was amazing, dude. Those were the great. You could get them on Fight Pass, I think, still. You could go back. They got the whole library there.
Oh, it's great. You know, so I'm training for Pancrase. I'm supposed to fight another young boy named Kunioku. I forget his full name, but Kuni, went by Kuni. He and I were supposed to debut together. And I was supposed to go live in Japan for 3 months and go do my internship there at a Pease Lab and stuff like that. But I was I was a striker. So my wrestling sucked and things like that. Everybody's wrestling was way better than mine. So there was always the King of the Hill kind of thing where you stay on the, you know, you stay in the middle of the ring and for 5 minutes you're grappling with somebody and you have to escape or reverse them.
Right.
So I always stayed on bottom, you know,
because
I couldn't reverse everybody. So I'm tired and exhausted, and I get this 250-some-pound dude, Scott Besick, on me.
Wow.
He's one of Ken's original Lion's Den guys, like one of his first. And I go to bridge him, and I'm so exhausted, my neck buckles under me.
Oh, no.
On top of me.
Oh, no.
And, so I have this really bad neck injury. I go, Ken takes me to this chiropractor. His chiropractor looks at the x-rays and everything. They're like, yeah, kid, you need a few months off, you know? And Ken, and I was like, ah, shit. Well, I can't live under Ken's roof without being productive and shit like that. I mean, back story is, you know, Ken was literally fostering me.
Right.
You know, I didn't have my own money to pay for shit. He was paying for my food and letting me live under his roof.
Just as
And,
Bob had kind of given that vibe, and then Ken's like naturally doing it because he grew up in that. Wow.
right. So, you know, Jason was buying his own food, shit like that. So me and Frank were basically fostered in. So I was like, well, maybe I should go home for a while, until this is healed up, and then I can come back. And Ken was like, yeah, let's have you go home, and then when you're ready, you're always welcome back.
Right.
So I go home,
What year is this?
the,
What is this? Like
it's it's
95?
still no, nope, still 94. I was only at Ken's for about 3 to 4
Dude, that's
months.
the same year I fucked my neck up real bad too. That same year, and it really changes everything, man. Or did for me. You're tougher than
It,
hell. I don't know
it's
how you came
very
back
it's
from it.
very limiting. It's
Yeah.
very limiting. But I go back home to Ohio, and I become a Mormon.
Yeah,
Two
that's crazy, dude. That's so crazy.
of my best friends, end up like joining the church, and they
Yeah.
start sharing it with me. These are my buddies, these are my
Sure.
best friends and stuff. So it's just like kind of like I'm down in the dumps, I'm in this low, and I'm really not looking for anything or anything like that, but they present to me this message of the restoration of all things, of God speaking to prophets again, and this is the true church, and everything started, it all made sense
Yeah, no,
finally.
listen, I mean, you and I have gone on in our own personal hanging out and chit-chatting about the church, like, 'cause I lived there, right, for 8 years. I
Yeah,
so
you're
many
welcome.
friends, I mean, and I'm into kind of all that magic stuff anyway. So I totally get it. I understand,
But I mean, let's go back though, the magic of what I was, how I got in the UFC, like I recognized something in it. I thought it
Yes.
was something new, but it was something very old.
No, dude, the whole Mormon thing
It's
is
just
very
a
magical, dude.
rebrand. But it's just a rebranding of ancient hermetics,
Yes, yes.
of Sumerian texts and, Kabbal and, Kabbalah and Zohar and, all that kind of stuff. It's all in there.
Yeah,
It's not a
Joseph, I
new
mean, we've
thing.
talked about this. Joseph Smith basically took like the Hermeticism and a lot of the rituals out of the Freemasonry, the magic stuff, and some of the secret stuff, and then decided to make a religion out of it. And so there's it does have a lot,
Exactly.
there's a lot of very appeal. I'm not a you and I've talked about this a million times. I'm not a religious person. I've never really been a religious person. But there is a lot of kind of spiritual aspects to the Mormon theology that does overlap with my own. It's just I don't believe in
Yeah.
religion or
The rest of
whatever.
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's just I recognized the truth that was in it, but I thought it was only strictly coming from that source.
Sure. And that's, I mean,
You know what I mean? I
you're
just
still
didn't
like
know it.
20 years old or something, right?
Still 19. I mean, this is all in 1994,
God
man.
dang, dude.
1994 is a pivotal fucking year for me. It's a, you know, it's a it's a huge like nexus
That's so
of
crazy, dude.
it's like a zip file, man. It's a
Yeah.
compressed file of information,
Yeah.
So I joined the church, and then in 96, after my year anniversary, I'm an elder and I go serve a mission in Las Vegas. I
I
meet
keep
Jason
thinking you were
Smith.
21. I keep thinking you were 21 because I was 21.
I turned 21 while I was in the missionary training center.
Oh my gosh.
So
Wow.
Christmas of
Wow.
94, I got baptized. So I was still 19 in 94, right? Christmas of
Wow.
94,
So
I was
you got to go
19.
on a mission.
Yeah, exactly. In Las
Wow.
Vegas.
Wow. I didn't know that. I
So
didn't know you did a mission. That's amazing.
yep, I met my wife in the missionary training center, or my future wife in the missionary training center,
That's
and
one of the best
you
things to me that the Mormon Church does. I know it annoys everybody when the Mormons come and knocking on the door and want to talk, but that whole program for the young people to just kind of boot them out into the real world
Yeah.
and do it
Well,
in a time when they're surrounded by, this religious thing that makes sure they don't get into drugs and all this kind of stuff. But for them to travel and see the world, I think it's one of the greatest things for young people, that whole
oh,
mission.
dude, it's incredible, actually. I mean, you're learning selflessness. You're, constantly in the service of others. The biggest quote from like, this one of these the presence of the church, Gordon B. Hinckley, was when you're feeling downtrodden and you're feeling depressed, forget yourself and go serve others. That is
Yes.
the fastest way to heal yourself and to, and that's fucking truth.
I agree. I
There's no
100%
way
agree.
of. That's completely and totally true. And I learned so much about like my personal magic, everything about everything, the best way I could describe myself is chaos magic, in the sense that I have.
Yeah, many, we got that. Many, we got that.
Many,
in
many landscapes. You know, I pull from many different sources of how I navigate through life and make decisions and you know, feel inspiration or revelation or whatever the hell you want to call it.
I mean,
or,
dude, that's ultimately synchronicities. Yeah, that's really what spirituality is about, right? Because to me, spirituality is following your own path. Religion's maybe following the spiritual path of another person. You know,
right. So you got 1994, big year for me, and then 96 comes around, I serve a mission, but then my neck gets me out of my mission because I, you know, the doctors actually thought I had multiple sclerosis, but it turns out the neck damage I had from a car accident previous to, you know, that I had in my high school year, and then the damage that I took at Lyons then, I was compromising a lot of the nerve roots, and you know, I my arms were going numb all the time, and stuff like that.
Yep. So what was it? C2, like C2 or C5 or something? What'd you get?
Actually, mine was C6 to T1 injuries.
Okay. That's so like the left arm. Is that your left arm? Yeah.
Yep. My left arm was completely ganked.
Because mine's all up in the C2 and C5, but I did crack my T1, but the my right hand is fucked. Because it was all the upper, the upper.
That's right. That's right. You and I are kind of like mirror images of each other when it comes down to the.
Yeah, but you're the mirror image that I wanted to be, dude. Like, seriously, man. Like, fucking when I was in 1994, I think I'm 2 years older than you. I wanted to fucking be doing that so bad. And that was like my prime, you know, before my body started breaking down. And I just, God, you just have such a great life. I you know, I know how it is. Like, you're living it and you're like, dude, yeah, feel my body. It doesn't feel great. But I'm just saying.
Yeah, you know, no, you and I, if there was ever two people that can identify with each other, you and I, you know, when we were comparing notes about, you know.
Where we've been and stuff, and yeah.
Feel. Yeah, and what it's taught us, too. That's the most important part is if we let it, we can either let it destroy us or teach us and build us up. And, you know, that's always the route that I always try to choose. Now I always go through, first, I go through the deep depression and,
you know, but yeah.
I'm like, well, fuck this. I'm pulling myself out of this. I'm not a quitter.
Right. Okay, wait. So you go on the mission, but on this mission, you find out that your neck is really fucked. Your arm is, you're probably getting stingers. You're losing feeling. Maybe it's atrophying. And so now what? You're Mormon. You're on a mission. So you have to come back. You can't walk. You can't do it anymore.
Yeah. So like I'm on my mission and everything, and I'm riding this girl, my wife Chelsea. You know, like because we met each other in Temple prep class right before we left. She's from Ohio as well, but we were an hour away from each other. We never met each other, and then we see each other again in the missionary training center, and. You know, we start writing each other while we're on our missions, and we basically got engaged on our missions.
Wow.
And, just through letter.
Wow. You know, that's so romantic, dude.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like modern day, you know, like internet.
And you're still together.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's so awesome. That's awesome.
I've been married half my life to this same person.
Wow.
So, but she goes off her mission early too, because she was in a car accident before her mission and both of her knees got embedded into a dashboard. So she couldn't do all the walking.
Yeah.
She definitely couldn't ride a bike, you know, things like that. So we actually were sent home off our missions at the same fucking time.
That's so cosmic, you know, dude.
It is, dude. There's just so many weird things. And, you know, we end up, you know, we got married in 1990, April 25th of 1997. Right, because I was only on my mission for about like 8 to 10 months, and same thing for her. And then we got married, and I settled down in Ashland, Ohio, and that was when I met the coach that I've been with. I've been with this coach for the past 22 years, named John Saylor.
Yes, yes. Judoka, big judoka.
Yeah, he used to be the head coach at the Olympic Training Center.
In Colorado, right. I know who he is.
And by being there, he was around so many different martial arts, and this is, you know, all before the UFC, he started putting together a mixed martial arts system called Shingitai. Shin meaning, you know, mind, Gi meaning technique, Tai meaning body. And he took all the best parts from all the different martial arts and basing it out of judo and coming up with a complete like system of this, right? So I go right. and meet this guy, and I'm like, whatever, you know, I'll go see what this guy's all about.
Yeah, you've been through you've been through the lion's den and shit, so you're probably a little right. jaded, yeah.
So the first thing, you know, I find out about him is he has his guys do 500 squats, do Hindu push-ups and all this shit. Because his mentor was Alan Kohaj.
Ah, yeah, UWFI, Bad News Alan.
Yep.
Yeah,
Bad
dude.
Bad News Brown.
Wow.
WWF, Bad News Brown.
Yeah, in WWF, he was Bad News Brown. Yeah, Bad News Alan in UWFI. Badass, huge.
Major fucking judoka, though.
Yeah, but a big, like a heavyweight technical judoka. A heavyweight technical judoka. To me, a no-gi judoka is a catch wrestler. I mean,
that is exactly how I describe catch wrestling. Well, how do you best describe it? Okay, judo without the gi.
And the pin is not 10. I mean, you know, but otherwise, dude, the movements, there's so much overlap. It's ridiculous.
Oh, it's complete. That's why catch wrestling and judo for me was like, it was such an easy transition. And for me, I've been with this guy for 22 years. I've been with him as long as I've been with my wife.
And
I just recently posted a pic of me, him, and my friend Cody Stevens. It's called the rule of three, or the law of three. I can't remember what I titled it, but it was just a picture of us in the basement, you know. But this guy really helped me, and even though I couldn't get the pancrase with Ken through training under John, I ended up having my first pancrase match. My first and only, but it was with Minoru Suzuki.
Which is, wait, okay, this is another commercial break because this is so fucking nuts, dude. Like, I mean, like, literally, I know, I love my life and I'm very blessed and I wouldn't trade it for anything. I really wouldn't. But I would trade some of the fucking crazy shit you've done, dude. That is, like, amazing, dude. Okay, we got to come back. Sean Doherty's with us. Guys, sit tight. The Do It Again podcast. We'll be right back. All right, guys, I'm your host, Jake Shannon. This is the Do It Again podcast. I'm thrilled to have a guy that I really respect, and I'm really happy that he's here on the line. Sean Doherty. Sean, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, so if you guys are just tuning in now, you've like totally missed like some epicness. Like, we started out talking about like how he was a kickboxer in the 90s into like Seagal and Van Damme. Smoked some weed, did some acid, got in the UFC, got in the lion's den, broke his freaking neck, became a Mormon, got married, had this totally romantic thing, then hooks up with like the head of the Olympic judo, John Saylor, and then you get booked in fucking Pancrase, the coolest promotion in my opinion to ever exist, against the baddest motherfucker. Now, I just want to preface this because So I got my initiation a little different. Because I actually had to do, Gotch's Bible for Gotch. You were talking about how like Ken would had to initiate Frank and all these kind of things. Now I didn't go, you know, Carl was an old man, so he didn't bust me up or any of that kind of stuff. But I did have to do Gotch's Bible and it was just fucking brutal. But I got to know Carl really pretty well, and I would just ream him because I was wanting information about catch wrestling and there was nothing out there. And I said, Carl, who should I learn from? Who should I learn from? Who is the best guy? Because he was all busted up. He showed me like four things, but he couldn't really show me anything because he was like really old. And
right. His hips, he was down in Florida?
Yeah, in Tampa. And so, but he said, my best student was Fujiwara. And I said, but who is the toughest catch wrestler you ever trained? And it always was Minoru Suzuki. So I'm sorry for derailing this and getting it to that. But So when the god of wrestling, Carl Gotch.
Minoru was my favorite fighter. When I lived at Ken's, we weren't allowed to watch any TV whatsoever except for Pancrase videos. My favorite, the guy who resonated with me the most was Minoru.
Mm-hmm. Mm. He was a badass. Like Carl always said, you can get all these other athletes, and he would rattle them off. I'm not going to say it because I don't want to embarrass anybody. But he said, once in a blue moon, you'll get a guy who can do all the stuff. He's agile. He's mentally tough. He could do all that. But really what takes it past anything is that killer instinct. And he said Minoru Suzuki had the killer instinct more than any other guy that he had ever trained. And
evil motherfucker, though.
Yeah, and you fought him.
He's evil.
You fought him. That is sick. And you didn't fight him. I mean, he's still going today. Like, I look at these guys, and I, albeit it's pro wrestling, but in some ways, pro wrestling is like stunt work. It's really hard on your body. He's still going and wrestling to this day. But you got him. What year was it that you wrestled Suzuki?
2000, April.
Oh, Jesus.
April 30th. It was the day before Funaki fought Hickson.
Wow. Wow. Okay, so maybe you could tell us the horror story involved with fighting Minoru Suzuki. That's got to be some crazy shit. Because you knew who he was, right? Like, how was it to get psyched up for that match?
Well, it was hard. I mean, it was like if a boxer liked Muhammad Ali, you know, if that was a fighter and they got to fight him, it was like,
wow. Yeah.
So I'm coming in, and I was brought in as a job boy. I realized this, you know, my manager was Phyllis Lee.
Yeah. She's here in Denver, isn't she?
Oh, she's dead now, but no, she was in Toledo.
Oh, Toledo. Okay.
You know, her son is X-Pac, you know. And,
She was
connected with Dean Malenko and like that. But she was the manager of Dan Severn, Shoni Carter, me, Chris Lytle, Jason Gotze.
Wow.
That was kind of like her crew.
I see.
But I got brought in. Minoru's, the background was that he had a neck injury or surgery, and he was coming back from it. So it was a big deal of a fight, and I come in. I'm all ganked up from the flight. My neck, you know. What's his name? The referee that they always had. He was also an acupuncturist and kind of like a chiropractor.
Oh, so he worked? Did he do some work on you? Then?
He worked on me and stuff like that. Tried to get me ready for the fight, but I was all ganked up, and I had to. Fight like this, and plus they didn't let me bring a corner man.
Oh,
Shoni had a corner man. All these people had a corner man, but me, because I was the job boy. I was not.
Yeah. They wanted to make sure that he went over.
Everything was a mind fuck for me.
Wow,
and that's the truth about it. You know, that's breaking kayfabe, but hey, I could break it even further. But
dude,
I'm not.
Yeah, but here's the thing. No, here's the thing. I wish people would understand. Like, you know, I think people look down their noses sometimes. At the business, and it's just how it works, dude. And it's happened in pro wrestling.
You're either a company man and you get invited back, or you're a prideful, you know, American and you don't.
Yeah,
you know, there's a certain rule, unspoken esoterics that is involved here.
Yep.
And so I got the clue, and you know, I'm not supposed to win, kind of thing. And, you know, so it's a total mind fuck. And I'm without John. He didn't get to come with me. So wow. Shoni took me under his wing, and he ended up in my corner.
Nice.
So we go in, and I go for some strikes. He goes in for a single leg, and he picks me up with a single leg and slams me. I get back to base. I get out from under him, and I stand back up, and then he takes me down again. So he, you know how Josh Barnett one time was like, there's a video of him describing Minoru's shin riding.
No, that was me asking him. That was me asking Josh. I was filming that. I was asking him about the shin ride.
So
yeah.
How I learned the shin ride was by Minoru doing it to me. I downloaded so much information.
Yeah, I bet.
Match against Minoru.
I bet.
And here's the other mind fuck. The whole entire time I trained for this was for open palm strikes, right? That night, that show was the very first time they did gloves.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Are you fucking kidding me?
So they fuck your whole game up right there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's just another thing. And nobody told me about it. It's just like, you know, I don't know if it was because my manager was shitty or what, but, you know.
Well, it could have been also they wanted to keep you in the dark to make sure that he went over. I mean, that's just... You know, that's just the
exactly
business. That's the business side of it.
Look, no offense to Minoru, you know, but, you know, that's the telling these things. I mean, no matter what, I think he would have beat me. But
right, right. You know, but they definitely try to stack things in your favor or in his favor.
Right, right. So I'm reading into everything, and I'm going with him, and he puts me in a double wrist lock, and I break the hold.
Wow.
And, you know, and I'm just kind of like, and I'm feeling his pressure and feeling his heaviness, and there's just no escape. So it was just like, what?
Hello?
What the fuck? And then he grabs the wrist lock again, and then he gets it.
Right.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Yeah,
I can hear you.
You just cut out for a second. It's okay.
So he gets the double wrist lock again, and this time I don't break the grip, and he takes it and he really cranks it back. And I had already just had two fucking shoulder surgeries a year.
Which arm? Which arm is this?
My left arm.
Ah! Oh, no. So,
and it's my weak one.
You know? That's the, well, of course, that's the one that's like already got the nerve damage and shit.
Yeah, so he does the thing where he holds it and screams and takes the fucking pictures and shit
Yeah, and here you're dying.
All right. Yeah, so we give each other a hug afterwards, and he whispers in my ear, thank you.
Yeah.
He knew what I did.
Yeah.
And he knew, you know, I did, you know, and I was trying to ensure that I can come back, you know, that kind of thing. So after the match, you know, I'm being interviewed, and they're asking me, you know, who would you like to fight now in Pancrasis? I go, Minoru Suzuki.
That's
awesome. What the fuck else? You know,
Dude, you fought, like, in Carl Gotch's estimation, the toughest catch wrestler, dude. Like, there's no fucking shame in that, dude. That's, like, amazing.
And he was my catch wrestling idol, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was the one that I, you know, adored, and, you know, I mean.
Well, it was actually Frank Shamrock. He had some random instructional video, you know, it was on VHS back in those days, and at the end of it, somebody asked him where he learned submissions, and he was just, yeah, Minoru Suzuki. And that's where I got on the trip, because I was like, man, that guy has got to have some knowledge. And then when I ended up having that really corroborated with Carl, I was like, holy shit. So for you to go in the ring with him, man, that is like, that's a dream. Even though I know it fucked you up and all that kind of stuff. But.
Yeah, no, but it really was. It really was. So after Pancras, you know, I'm hoping to get fights, you know. And Phyllis Lee, she's telling me about this fight coming up in Venezuela, you know, but I had already started joining the military. So 2000, I fought in Pancras, April 2000. And then I went to college and started going. I was figuring I'd go to college and fight, you know, I'd fight my way through college, but I wasn't getting any fights. I was just doing these underground matches like in Michigan and local shit. And nothing sanctioned, nothing, you know, literally illegal matches.
Like
underground matches.
Yeah, like side bet matches and stuff.
Yeah, we can get arrested kind of shit.
Yep.
If it was raided or whatever. So I decide, well, I got to take care of my family somehow. So I start the delayed entry program in May of 2001. I tried going to the Marine Corps, but because I had prior shoulder surgeries to that, they said,
and this is the Air Force, right?
Marine Corps first, like I.
Oh, I see.
And they
I said, see.
They completely rejected me, but they told me to go to the Air Force.
Okay.
And so I went to the Air Force. I'm like, what's the toughest thing you got? You know, and like pararescue, combat control. Okay, I want to do that. You know, I passed this. I was doing like 20 handstand pushups at the time.
Yeah. Like you're probably killing PT. All the guys are hating you, probably.
Right. So you know, and then, so I was supposed to swear in on September 11th.
Wow.
Of 2001.
Wow.
And, you know, the planes are flying into the thing. So I call my recruiter. I'm like, I guess we're not going today, right? And I, sorry if there was a bunch of noise there. I had somebody calling me.
It's okay. Hold on. it's that when you get on a group text thing, right?
Well, no, this is actually somebody trying to call me, and I got to let them know I'm on a fucking podcast.
Well, I won't keep you too much longer anyway. So 9/11 happens, and you are supposed to be sworn in that day. Are you there?
Right, yeah, I'm supposed to be sworn in, and the planes crash, so I swear in on actually September 12th.
Wow. That's a whole new era, dude. There was a day before and a day after, and that's when you... So you do that, and I know that's where you end up meeting Joel Bain.
Yep, that was like towards the end of my career. So I go in and I try out for combat control. I make it through selection, but during the second day of selection, I tore my shoulder off the bone.
Ugh.
The labrum was completely torn off. And I finished the 2-week selection course with that. Didn't know it was
bad,
but I do the whole entire fucking selection with a partial, you know, I was torn from 12 o'clock to 9 o'clock.
Jesus.
On my left shoulder. So it was like just a quarter of my labrum was still connected to the bone. So,
now wait, are you still with the Mormon church at this time?
Yeah. I'm still a Mormon.
Okay.
And then, I that happens to me, and then I have to drop out of the course, and they reclass me into air transportation, which was the very job I said I never fucking wanted. Like when I was going through all the job selection, I was like, God, that sounds horrible. I never want that fucking job.
But
I have a 6-month-old kid at home, my wife. Living,
yeah.
You know, and I'm like, okay, well, just because I can't do this special forces thing doesn't mean I can't be in here and.
You got responsibilities, right?
You know, and I'm always self-sacrificing, and I never get my own anyway. So, you know, even to this day, kind of thing, it's like my whole fucking mantra in life is to live for others, I guess. You know, and it sucks, but it's cool. But you know, it's like,
well, oh, you know, give me a break. In Hinduism, you know, there's a you know, Hanuman, who is like the patron saint of wrestlers and stuff in the Hindus. And he's like a reincarnation of Shiva and all this. And he does the whole mace thing that, you know, but, you know, he said there's like two ways to worship Hanuman, and they'll give you two completely different lives. You could take the heroic journey, but then you're going to get enemies and, you know, you could get killed and all that, or you could take the journey of service. And that means you have masters, but you know, you're leading a good life and you're helping people. And I've always tried to take that similar route as yourself and more of the service route, you know? Instead of the heroic journey kind of thing.
Yeah, it just seems to be my path. You know, like every time I've tried the heroic journey, I just get destroyed. So,
yeah,
you know, my karma doesn't match the dharma. So,
right.
You know.
So when did you? This is where I'm really curious. So now you're kind of on the you're on the sunset of your fight career. This is right around 2001 ish, right? And at what point do you decide to kind of go on your own spiritual thing and leave the church behind? And how is that also kind of with your wife? Cause she was also Mormon, you know, did you both have, you know, a similar kind of feeling and you know, how did that work for you?
Yeah. Well, so I got my shoulder injured, you know, 2001, I get reclassed, and then I'm in Dover, Delaware, for a year, and then I get orders to Okinawa. I get sent out to Okinawa.
Oh, wow.
For 3 years. My wife and I and my two sons at the time were living there.
Wow.
And I was part of this thing called the Combat Mobility Element. What we were was a mobile airport. Like, we would break ground and create an air hub and wait until somebody else would come and relieve us, like a permanent party, and then we would go someplace else and open up another era. So when the 2005 tsunami hit in Jakarta, Sumatra, our unit was alerted, and we were the first Americans on the ground helping recover the tsunami relief. And I was there, and it's just like my world changed. I was just like, holy shit, you know, like looking at the devastation, but yet seeing the smiles on everybody's faces and the happiness that I saw, even in the midst of the most treacherous adversity that you can imagine, the devastation, you know. And so I started off in Utapau, Thailand, and then we went and flew a mission, 12-hour mission from Sumatra to Jakarta, or Jakarta to Sumatra, I can't remember which way. But we were flying supplies in, and then I finished out in Sri Lanka. But anyways, during that time, that was, you know, I was a major hardcore, like, right-wing conservative.
Yeah, the kind of the typical Mormon kind of thing. Yeah.
and
military, Air Force after 9/11, like all that. Yeah.
Yeah. Hoorah. You know, and then like the compassion of it all just kind of changed me. I mean, I'm not saying I became a Democrat, liberal or anything. I'm just saying that I gave up on politics. I gave up on the recent, the paradigms of America. And it was just like, I started questioning everything, and I started questioning my religion, you know, everything. And then after that time, so I got 3 years in Okinawa, and then my body, I recovered my body to the point where I can go back through the pararescue selection course. And I went through that twice. Each time it fucked me up, and I still have an invite back. I was never quite washed out in the way people think. I was still friends with everybody. Like, they always wanted me to come back. You know, they used to fly me out early just so I could train the cadre. And then, you know, before my class started,
sure.
You know, kind of thing. But, you know, there's like, you know, you are, and you're a PJ in your heart, you know, you're a PJ before you're a PJ kind of thing, you know, but I never made it.
Sure.
You know, I never got through the training. My body just couldn't do it.
Yeah. I understand.
So I ended up having 18 surgeries by the end of it all.
Ugh.
You know, I was having back-to-back surgeries in 2003 till 2006, I was in Okinawa. 2007 through 2010, I was stationed in New Jersey. 2007, I went through pararescue twice. 2008-09 was all the surgeries to repair that.
Wow.
And I was insane. They had me on 8 different medications, you know, shit like that. You know, my saving grace was Joel Bain, meeting Joel. You know, he heard about me, and, you know, he was like, he was somebody who was training in jiu-jitsu, but didn't really want it. He wanted to do catch wrestling.
Right.
Things like that. So we hooked up, and he literally basically kept me sane and kept me alive by literally grabbing me and making me train him every single fucking day.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, but is this also, and Joel is amazing. I mean, what he's been doing with catch has been really, like, honestly, like a relief for me, because I mean, he is just really carrying the ball in a great way. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with you. He's very differential, towards you. But you hook up with Joel, and then, like, I mean, I am still curious, and I don't want to pry if you don't want to say, it's okay. But then, like, how did that work? Cause I know so many Mormon couples, and sometimes, you know, one loses, they don't want to be part of that religion anymore, and the other one does, or whatever. Did you both kind of just exit at the same time?
At that time we were still like, so my last 2 years in the Air Force, I moved my wife and kids back to Ohio so I can use our basic allowance for housing to actually go towards something.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought a house and had that go towards that, where I was literally alone, a vagabond, and at my base, you know, I was working every day, but I was living with different people at different times. And Joel gave me purpose and direction as far as my mind was concerned. And through training him and others for 2 years straight there. And then I finally got medically retired and came back home. It wasn't until about 2012 where everything really started solidifying. Things started coming together in 2012. I found sacred geometry.
I see.
And I started going down this rabbit hole. And from all the experiences I've had from all my surgeries and going in and out of anesthesia and just challenging life and seeing things through a whole other lens, I started questioning everything.
Sure.
The Proposition 8 thing was happening, and I didn't agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the church was majorly against everything, and
yeah, they were funding Prop 8 in California.
And I'm like, what the fuck? You know, we're supposed to be apolitical. We're not supposed to be a political entity. We're not supposed to be getting involved in politics ever. But yet here we are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so and then with the internet, me finally being able to have time and be on the internet, I started really doing my research.
Right.
And check, you know, and when a good sign of a cult is when they say, don't listen to anybody else but us.
Yeah.
Don't do any of your own research.
Right.
So I started doing my own research and finding the hermeneutics of the church history, and also just things from the church itself revealing stuff. And I started realizing, I was like, wait a minute, nothing is adding up. You know, everything is contradicting itself. You know, I really got to look at this. And my wife was like, about fucking time.
So she was already there.
She was secretly kind of like, you know, like, eh, this is bullshit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it was a mutual thing, and all of our kids were like, yeah, let's get the fuck out of Dodge, Dad. they were tired of having bishops ask them if they were beating off or, you know.
Yeah, it's weird, dude.
You know, it gets really intense and really, you know, invades a lot of private space that nobody should be fucking dealing with.
Yeah, my wife and her family all were LDS, and she's no longer LDS. And some of those crazy stories of like, like these bishops are not like experts or authorities on anything, and yet they're all up in your business and telling you what to do, and it's kind of weird how that works. So you got out, and now like you're just very kind of spiritually aligned with your own kind of vision.
Yeah, I mean, things started making sense for me, and you know, I mean, it was an upside down. Like I felt betrayed, you know, the shit that I believed in. But you know, as I look at it, it's like, that was my own fucking fault. You know,
well, the internet's great that way, right? Because you just have a lot of different views and you could kind of see what at least makes sense to you.
Right. So, you know, it was 2016 was when we actually left the church, and, you know, we were just like, okay, we're going on our own, and life has been 1,000 times better for us.
I just think there's probably less pressure or whatever. Yeah, I think as far as religions go, I think it's a good religion, not a horrible religion. But you know, I'm just not a religious person, so I totally see why you would not want to be part of it.
And I delved more into sacred geometry. I became a third degree Mason, and that was another thing. By becoming a third degree Mason, I learned that, wait a minute, my whole religion was based off.
Yeah, it's all very familiar, but wait a minute, this is older and what? Yeah, I get that. Yeah,
I mean, people used to make the connections like, oh, the temple, you know, is what is connected to Masonry or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, the whole religion, the doctrines even, you know, right. Even the very doctrines of the church were more Masonic than anything. I was like, so then I really started understanding about hermetics and, Sumerians and, you know, just all throughout history, you know, like that this stuff was always there. And Mormonism is just simply a retelling of many different things put into a pot and mixed together.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it was just like, okay, I get it now. All right. So now it's time to move on now. And I haven't thrown it all away. I mean, there's parts of it that I, you know, that are beneficial and that I still use to this day, but, you know, but it's not the same, but it opened up many, many doors to other things. And, I'm very happy, you know, like it's like at first, you know, my reality was literally turned upside down. I felt like I went insane.
Yeah, sure.
You know,
cause everything that you'd been told for like a big giant chunk of your life is like totally not even something to base anything on. Right.
Yeah. 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 So it was just a very, you know, wild thing. And, Yeah, it's like we're all it's a part of our history now, not part of the present. You know, our some family members are kind of distraught over it, but
yeah,
you know, I've explained to them, you know, hey, look, I'm still that same fucking person. I
choosing to serve people. It's just I'm not wearing that badge.
Yeah, I'm not giving all credit to the church. Yeah. I'm not giving the credit to something else. You know, or even taking credit. It's just, you know, you just do the right fucking thing.
Yeah.
I've always been a good person, and the church didn't make me that.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
I made the church better.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know. Dude, I am so, I really appreciate you spending all this time. I know your phone's blown up and I think we're creeping in on 90 minutes already, which is like amazing. So if you want to get a hold of Sean, he's on Facebook, SeanDaughtry. You could also go to the snakepitusa.com website. I'm sure you send the email to the general email. They'll make sure Sean gets it. What else is going on? I mean, I know with Snake Pit, you're going to like Columbia, you're doing all these kind of outreach things. What else is, any goals or anything, or are you just still kind of just surfing?
Since 2010, I've been affiliated with Strong Style, with Marcus Marinelli, who also a Fujiwara Gumi lineage.
Oh, cool.
Like he's actually like the equivalent of Ken Shamrock.
Yeah, okay.
You know, the strong style, you know, Stipe Miocic, you know, the former heavyweight champ, the UFC, you know, he's had tons of UFC fighters, but he's been doing it since 93, 94. You know, so he and I are, you know, the OGs in Ohio of that.
Well, and I see forward. Emil, that your guy, Emil Fisher, right? Like, is he out of that gym?
Yeah, he's out of that gym. That's the only gym that accepted him because he's just so wild. And, you know, but a super awesome guy. He's a Jewish fella. He's one of the best fine menches I've ever met in my life.
Well, he's kicking ass. I mean, I keep seeing him post all these wins left and right. And,
yeah. In 2016, he picked me up, and I've been his private instructor since 2016 in leg locks.
Oh, nice.
But what he's doing now, though, has got nothing to do with me. He's like, he has taken leg locks to another level for himself.
You know? Awesome.
I gave him a foundation to work from, and he went from there. And that's something, you know, I don't ever want anybody to be my drone. I don't want anybody to be a carbon copy of me. Mm-hmm. I teach people to learn and to become their own creators.
Good.
You know, in a sense, I'm, you know, my job isn't to create servants, but to create gods. Mm. You know, people who can create for themselves.
Yes.
You know? And I never want someone to be just like me. I want them to be the best that they can be of themselves, the best version. So
I love that.
That's my training philosophy, is to teach people how to teach themselves, you know, learn how to learn.
Yeah.
Billy Robinson would say.
Yeah. I love that. That's amazing. So you're doing stuff there, and then you're traveling around and
I'm my own brand. Yeah. I'm my own brand, you know, most of it, you know, and, you know, I love going around doing seminars. There's times I'm representing Snake Pit USA. There's times I'm representing myself, you know, but to me, it's all one.
Well, and you also, I mean, you have a lot of experience in the gi, because I see you doing gi seminars and stuff like that as well.
Yeah. That was because of John Saylor. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that. And plus I'm a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu under Carlos Catania, you know, who is a fucking phenomenal guy as well. You know, his technique is sick. So, you know, I'm very fortunate, you know, for my life, you know, it's been a wild ride and it's not quite over yet. So let's see what's to come.
Well,
you know, and I finally got to meet you. My last seminar I did, I was at the gym and I picked up one of your mace balls. This guy has
a mace ball. Yeah. It's crazy how big that's gotten.
I did my warm up with it, you know, before I got on the mat. You know,
oh, good.
I was thinking about you the whole time.
Yeah, dude, that thing has gotten so crazy big. It's like gotten away from me. It's huge. It's kind of like your thing, like where I taught a few people and they've gotten way better than me. And those people they taught have gotten better. It's like this huge thing now. But
isn't it cool, though?
It's cool to see.
You dropped the pebble.
It's crazy. Well, hey, Sean, I really appreciate the time you spent with me on the podcast, because I think you're such a self-effacing guy, and I think, you know, a lot of people need to know who you are and your accomplishments, and I just really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate it, too. I always enjoy your company, and whenever I'm out in Denver, I always try to find you.
Man. So, that was fun going to Mammoth, dude.
I truly consider you a friend in my life. It's been awesome. I'm glad we finally met.
Yeah, likewise. Likewise.
Like a year ago.
Yeah, maybe. I think it's maybe 2 years, but it's probably a year and a half. But yeah, it's been amazing. Yeah. Again, thanks, brother. So guys, Sean Dougherty, check him out. He's on Facebook. You can message me. I'll send you his info as well. Take care, Sean. I appreciate it, brother.
All right. Love you, brother.
Love you.
Take care.